Good morning. Welcome to Shattering Myths, a program devoted to the largest segment of society, to those who know that the world's religious, political, economic, and military institutions are corrupt, even counterproductive. I am Yada. If you'd like to join us, our toll-free number is 877-300-7645. Yesterday, we ended our news hour talking about the murder of Christians in Libya by the Islamic State, and these were Ethiopian Christians. There was a little more to that article that I wanted to share with you because it is instructive. It says that Ethiopia has long drawn the ire and anger of Islamic extremists. So it's trying to justify the murder. As if, you know, that in every conflict there has to be a grievance on both sides. And that's one of the biggest issues relative to the reporting on Islam. Where it is the most egregious is as it relates to the what's called the Arab-Israeli conflict and sometimes called the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. To give the impression that both sides are wrong, that both sides are antagonists, that both sides are to blame. And that just isn't the case with Islam. Islam is very seldom ever provoked. Muhammad was never provoked, and he led 75 ruthless terrorist raids, robbing and raping everyone within camel ride of Mecca and then Medina. Not a single attack perpetrated by Muhammad was provoked. And the same thing is true today. This has Ethiopia drawing the anger of Islamic extremists, first of all, as we know, and we're going to always correct the record, there is no such thing as an Islamic extremist. They're just Muslims. If a Muslim isn't violent, they aren't a Muslim. And if a Muslim is violent, then they're just a Muslim. The Quran makes that distinction. It's not my interpretation. It's not trying to smear the religion inappropriately. It is just the basis of Islam. The Quran is the arbitrator. The Quran says you cannot be a peaceful Muslim. That if you are peaceful, if you do not engage in and support jihad, which is an armed struggle, and in Muhammad's case, against defenseless civilians, to plunder them, to enslave them, to rob them, and to rape them, then you cease to be a Muslim. So it says that Ethiopia has long, long, oh, Ethiopia's bad, boy. Ethiopia had it coming to them. They were long drawn the anger of Islamic extremists over its military attacks into neighboring Somalia. Why in the hell, journalist, if I can be so kind with that label, do you think Ethiopia has gone into Somalia? Do you think they've gone into Somalia because it's the garden state of northeastern Africa? Do you think they've gone into Somalia because, boy, that really looks appealing and we would really like some of that hell that they have over there? Somalia is the single most dysfunctional country on earth. Of course, it's 100% Islamic. Those things seem to go together. There is no place on earth that is as savage, as brutal, as repressive, as repulsive, as dysfunctional as Somalia. No one goes into Somalia because they want some of that. Ethiopia goes into Somalia militarily for a singular reason, the same reason that Kenya does. And that is because Somali Muslims aren't properly contained. They aren't caged. They aren't quarantined, which is what needs to be done. And they cross that border, and then they perpetrate savage repulsive and perverted attacks on civilians in Ethiopia and Kenya. And they do it over and over again. They do it so routinely that the only way to deal with them is to try to attack the source. Now, of course, the problem in Kenya and Ethiopia is the same problem the world over. And that is that the religion of Islam is not held accountable. And the hosts of that religion are not seen as the cause. If they were, then Ethiopia, like Kenya, would simply quarantine them. They would build a massive wall, and they would export every Muslim out of their country back into Somalia, where they could not perpetrate such heinous acts. The last one, of course, in Kenya, was perpetrated by Somali Muslims who infected Kenya. Of course, there were also Muslims whose parents were residents of Kenya. You have to eliminate the Islam if you're going to eliminate terrorism. But to suggest that Ethiopians, the Christians in Ethiopia, had it coming to them because they responded to Somali Islamic aggression is like blaming the Israelis for defending themselves against the constant onslaught of Islam. But Muslims, nonetheless, indoctrinated, fooled by the world's most foolish religion, say that, and this is the video that was promoted by the Islamic State as they were murdering these Christians. While the militant video at one point said, "Muslim blood that was shed under the hands of your religion is not cheap." And so they're saying that Ethiopia is a Christian nation. The majority of Ethiopians are Christian. It's as much a Christian nation as the United States. It's the majority religion. I'm not even sure in the United States Christianity really is the majority religion anymore. I would suspect that socialist secular humanism, particularly in young people, is the most popular religion in America. But they are saying that we will kill you because you killed us. But they won't bother to think that the only reason the Ethiopians killed them is because they had launched attack after attack, mercilessly murdering civilians. We have Glenn on the line, and I want Glenn's opinion on labeling of conflicts, as this journalist did, as the Ethiopians had it coming to them. Hello, Glenn.
Good morning. I listen to, the media describe and the politicians complain about RT being propaganda.
Yes.
Pretty much everything we see in all of our media is propaganda. And The weasel worders and spin doctors and liars and manipulators are never going to tell the truth. And they're always,
No.
So I'm just kind of used to it,
Yeah, and I don't want to, well, it is pervasive. And they are never going to change. That's all true. When we become callous to it, and if there isn't someone out there that's willing to be an irritant, to say, these are weasel worders. What they're saying here is nothing but propaganda. And it's now propaganda, of course, for America's media religion, which is secular socialist humanism. And so it's political correctness to convey it this way. Those Christians always have it coming to them.
Right. It's crazy.
The Muslims are never wrong.
Did you see the story recently about the Muslim couple on an Australian commuter train?
What was the story there?
There was a Muslim couple, man and wife, sitting there. Wife had a headscarf on. And this was like a YouTube thing. There was this heavyset white lady sitting across from them, and she was complaining to them, berating to them about Muslims killing Christians. Mm-hmm. And this other, and we don't know of her religion, really, and this other woman.
And by the way, that's appropriate for her to say. And it is appropriate to let people know that in the name of their religion, horrible things are happening.
Yes, but she was the bully, Yada. The story was that this other woman, another white woman, we don't know her religious background, began berating the woman who was berating the Muslim
people. Oh, okay, yes, because we can't hold.
For bullying them. And this made the news. This became a news story, and they and even ended up, and she was interviewing the second woman about how she, you know, it was so good of her to intervene on behalf of the poor bullied Muslim couple.
And the bully, the woman who was the moral voice. The moral voice there is the one who would not tolerate evil. But you see, in political correctness, we are intolerant of Christianity, but we're tolerant of Islam.
Right. Well,
and so she was intolerant of the Christian. Right. And she was then presented as this advocate for tolerance.
Exactly. She was a tolerant tyrant. She was just doing her civic duty because she didn't want Australia, you know, people think this is...
Yeah, even though she was wholly and completely intolerant of the truth. The Christian woman was telling the truth.
And probably completely ignorant of the circumstances. But
that is correct.
She's not, exactly.
Yeah, so that is how far we have fallen. You know, I don't have any illusions, Glenn. I have no illusions that the message that we're conveying, which is that we are being lied to in every possible way by the media, by the government, by our military, by those who guide the country economically, and by every religion, as well as by most professors, particularly outside of the sciences. I make no illusions that none of that's going to change. And the expose we're doing, where we're exposing and condemning these institutions, isn't going to change those institutions. It's not going to save America or any country. These trends are unstoppable. We are way too far gone to make a difference collectively. But I think you would agree, we can absolutely make a difference individually. And that's why we say these things. Returning to the point that Glenn was making and that I was trying to make, which is that there is no illusion on our part that we are ever going to influence the media to be honest, to do their job, to actually become journalists again, to think. Because the media is probably the most ardent bastion of political correctness. The only two places where political correctness run amok to the same degree they do in the American media would be in academia, which is the wellspring of this religion. It's where the priests reside of political correctness, and then in politics. And so in those three places, we are not going to make a difference. But we can make a difference individually. If we reach individuals who have a sense, the ears of individuals who have a sense that there's something wrong with their religion, something wrong with their country politically, something wrong with the military, something's not quite right, and the illusions that are being presented about things like quantitative easing and what the real impetus is behind it, what's the cause and consequence, that those individuals can be convinced to begin to question and then distrust and then disassociate from religion and politics and patriotism and the like. And once they disassociate from those things, then for the first time in their lives, they're going to be open to coming to know who Yahweh is and the path that he has provided home. So I think in that regard, it's worth it. You have an impression on that?
Oh, yeah. Well, the word, of course, hovering in my mind relative to all that is remnant. You know, remnant.
Yes.
Yahweh's not saving the world. You know, we always present all these hero shows where the hero saves the world. Yahweh is not saving the world. He's saving those who come to him.
Right.
you know?
Right, exactly.
And he's, you know, relating to and redeeming those who come to him. I think it's in Proverbs, you know, where wisdom cries aloud in the marketplace, you know? And it's just
right.
Like you know, wisdom crying aloud and very
right.
Listening. And,
you know, I think that all of the revelations that we're exposing here on this show, I think they're obvious. I think that you can see the problems everywhere. And if you actually take a moment and dig down under the surface of those problems, you realize there is no resolution to them. So the collective institutional problems are crying out in the marketplace. And they say, don't trust human institutions.
Well, and to the degree that anyone, regardless of whether or not they come to Yahweh, it can be persuaded to care at all about others, or to care about propositional truth, and perhaps, you know, guide their behavior, you know, accordingly, you know, that sort of helps tamp down evil in the world. You know what I mean? I mean, the world has always been evil. Humans have always been sinners. There's
right.
always been wickedness, but it's a matter of degrees. I mean, sometimes
right.
things are worse and worse than others, and sometimes people are worse than others. So to the degree that we can inculcate even some sort of caring about truth or others, you know,
sure.
makes our world a little better.
You know, it's like putting a spotlight outside of a alley doorway in a troubled neighborhood.
Right,
when the
exactly.
light goes on, the bandits and perpetrators and muckruckers are less likely to continue murderous or immoral behavior. People that are doing things. You know, there's a reason that, you know, why do you think that jihadists wear black masks over their face?
Yeah, because they don't want the truth to be known.
They don't want to be seen. They don't want to be seen. They know what they're doing is wrong. They don't want to be seen. And when you turn on a light, people that are doing things that are inappropriate have a tendency to say, you know, can you turn that light off or I'm going to stop doing this. So, yeah, when you shine a light on things like this, I think it does have a tendency to mitigate the amount of harm. But in our case, we're dealing with a flood of immoral and inappropriate behavior, and a few fingers in the dam is not going to stop it.
But it's sort of like cockroaches. But the cockroaches have one advantage: they can survive the radiation of a nuclear attack. Humans can't.
Yeah, that's right. You know, it's interesting, Glenn, that when you read Yashayah, the saddest part of Yashayah to me is that Yahweh, as he progresses from the time about 750 BCE that he is speaking through Yashayah, through the time of the arrival of of Yahusha to fulfill the first four of the Moed Mikre, Pesach, Matzah, Bukkudim, and Shavuah, that from that time to essentially our time, Yahweh constantly says, I was looking for someone. I was trying to find someone who I could work with. I couldn't find anyone.
But here I am, Yahweh. Send me.
Yeah. Yeah, how many? There have been centuries upon centuries, millennia, where there was no one, according to God. He could not find someone to say that, here I am, send me. And even in this regard, most of the people that he approaches, the first response is, you know, I'm sure you can send someone better than I am. I'm happy to get to know you and be in this relationship. But like Moshe, could you send somebody else? We'll be back. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. In this particular case, this video that we were talking about, where the Muslim is saying that they were justified in killing the innocent Christians, which is what Muslims do. They almost always attack defenseless individuals. That they were justified in doing so because the blood that was shed on the hands of the religion of Christianity deserved no less. And I really have a tough time with this, and Glenn, this is one of my big issues with World War II. And that is that this notion that if somebody attacks you, you don't first determine whether or not there was cause and consequence for it. You just say, they attacked us, I must respond. And it's like, you know, the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, and they were successful in their bombing of Pearl Harbor for lots of reasons that were made so by stupid actions on behalf of the United States. And that rather than simply holding the, coming up with a plan that would deal with that in the most efficient way, we decided that we would declare war on Japan. And it's a war that we sacrificed hundreds of thousands of American lives to avenge the 3,000 sailors who were killed on that day. And we perpetrated the war towards the end by killing as many as 50,000 Japanese civilians a night, burning them alive. And I just keep on saying, how is that reasonable?
Well, that's actually a lot. What a lot of people miss in this is that there was a transition after, you know, well, I don't know, sort of during the time of the Civil War, and then it certainly and left, you know, some in World War One, from military war to total war, in which it became considered cricket to attack civilian populations.
Right.
You know, this wasn't historically done that much. We saw it in Sherman's March to the Sea in the Civil War. We saw the battle lines
right.
in trench warfare in World War One, but by World War Two, it was complete total war, bomb civilian populations approach.
You know, but if you look at the first probably 50 wars that the European colonists fought here in North America, almost all of them were perpetrated as total war, where the Indians were, the native peoples were considered savages, and that their entire communities were ravaged with tens of thousands of women and children being burned alive.
Right. So the idea of the battlefield as the theater of operations is
right.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. And there were places in ancient history where particularly the Romans were especially good at holding the population accountable, and that's not even an appropriate way to word it. They would punish the population if they were attacking the army, so that the Romans wanted a legacy of you screw with us and we will wipe you out, so that it's as if you never existed. And so the Romans perpetrated war that way. There were others that fought wars of, you know, for the most part, army to army. But you look at Alexander the Less Than Great. Most of Alexander's battles were against civilian populations, where he would besiege a civilian population like the way the Romans would do after him. And all of the civilians would pay a horrid price because he wanted what they had. And so, you know, we have this tendency to focus on the military maneuvers and not realize that humans are awesomely savage, brutal, sadistic.
Right.
And that's how we perpetrated World War II. We were sadistic. I mean, you look at what we did when we firebombed Dresden. Think of the people that were burned alive.
Right. We are barbaric, and it does, and the fact, and you know, we have this idea of standoff technologies, where you know we have when you drop a bomb from 30,000 feet in the air, you know, you don't see the devastation you've caused.
Right. You would have a very difficult time getting a soldier to douse women and children in a napalm, a sticky form of gasoline. And then light the match and watch them burn alive, and then to do it again and again and again. But you can get them to fly airplanes at 30,000 feet and to drop incendiary bombs on those people.
Yeah, or when politicians who love to send the military up but never send their own kids, You know, if you're not one of the fortunate ones, if you're not a senator's son, like the song said, you know, you get to go out, and especially if in Vietnam, if you're black, you get sent to the front lines. You know, so yeah, the humans are barbaric, and they're also cowards.
And it's interesting. I was watching a snippet from the news the other night, and this fellow that had served a number of tours in Afghanistan and Iraq came back with PTSD, and he tried to commit suicide, and finally the only way he could get his life back together is he became an isolationist and found himself for better part of a year on the Appalachian Trail, and now he is trying to help other returning soldiers recover from the stress, the trauma of what they witnessed and what they perpetrated in Iraq and Afghanistan.
That sounds very therapeutic, getting away from all of the horrible stimuli and clearing your head and get ready.
Right. And the reason I bring that up is that if you look at Vietnam, the drug use and the alcohol abuse amongst the soldiers in Vietnam was rampant. And it was rampant because they had to numb their conscience, because what they were doing was they knew there was no way of looking at what we did in Vietnam in the field as being positive. We would tell people to go and take a hill. We would lose lots of lives taking the hill, and the moment we took the hill, we would retreat from the hill, and the Vietnamese would return. And the people we were fighting for were corrupt, and that there was no way we were going to impose America, our values, on them. And by bombing and with the napalm and the Agent Orange, we were destroying rather than building, and we were manufacturing enemies, not friends. And so they had to numb their conscience. That's the only way you could be over there, was to use drugs and alcohol. Otherwise, you'd go crazy.
And the military took a lesson from that. So it's standard, you know, conventional wisdom in treating people wrestling with street drugs, that they are often attempting to self-medicate for a mental problem.
Right.
And in this case, we're talking about depression caused by the cognitive dissonance of all the evil they're doing. So now we keep the soldiers out for five tours, and they just pump them full of the drugs.
Right, of course. And exactly. You look at Afghanistan and Iraq, and it's vastly worse than Vietnam, because now you're dealing with Islam. And where communism is a corrosive doctrine, it's absolutely a corrosive and counterproductive ideology. It assimilates into a central core all of the evil of man, which is why it's so deadly. But there has never been a doctrine more malignant than Islam. And so now you're sending Americans out to impose American systems on people who are literally savages. And the whole experience there is just completely and totally destructive of one's conscience, because you know that what you're doing isn't good. It's counterproductive. You've been indoctrinated to believe your military is good, and that you're doing a service for the American people. So you cling to that. And then you see what you're doing, and you come back traumatized because these things just don't mesh.
The guys who break under those circumstances have consciences,
right?
And they're less of a threat than the guys who don't break and become like sociopaths and psychopaths and come back and
they come back as police. They come back as police and as sheriff and as federal agents. That's what they come back as.
Like, that's the dangerous. They're the dangerous ones, and they're the ones
of
that are steroids and SSRI.
Right.
And they become monsters.
And they're medicated. They're medicated. Right. There are 600,000 returning vets from Afghanistan and Iraq that have claimed PTSD, who are being medicated for PTSD, who are receiving $6,000 a month from the U.S. government, who are said that, in effect, they're dysfunctional, and we're drugging them.
Well, this guy had the presence of mind to get himself out to the nature for a while and to get away from the stimuli.
Yeah, I don't think you ever recover from that, though. I mean, I just don't think you ever recover.
No, but you increase your coping ability.
Yeah, I would agree.
You can wrestle with it more effectively. And the other guys who become cops handcuff women and then punch them in the back while they're sitting against the kitchen counter. We don't need that.
Yes. You know, one of the things that just stuns me in America today that we have created a culture where those that we are paying, the police, the federal agents, can usurp a person's liberty, their freedom, without cause. They can demean an individual, have that individual grovel in the dirt. They can handcuff and abuse that individual. They can arrest, which is to rob a person of their freedom, without any justification. And then if they resist that and say, no, I'm not going to stop what I'm doing. You have no authority over me. In fact, I pay your salary. I've done nothing wrong. Then they will imprison you for resisting arrest. And if the cop is particularly belligerent, they'll kill you in the process.
And even if you submit, and they become so horrific, they come to lie. I mean, I stand in a thin blue line lie to cover its tracks and stuff.
Right.
But even if you submit and they decide to be violent, then they lie about you, and then you have almost no means of exoneration.
That is correct. Yeah, the whole system is now counterproductive. It's hopelessly corrupt. It isn't salvageable. And that's because those who are given the badges and given the authority to rob us of our freedoms came out of the military culture. And as the War College determined, the one common denominator in the U.S. military, from the highest officers down to the lowest enlisted person, is that lying and deception run rampant. That they would lie even if the truth sounded better. And now you have these people providing testimony in the federal judiciary system. The whole system's corrupt. It is surprising to me that a jury finds a cop's testimony credible. It's as if they put on that badge and they come in that uniform and that we have been indoctrinated and positioned such that we, juries, find the police's testimony credible. It's like the FBI crime lab. You know, they find the government's testimony in these regards credible, even though they know that politicians, which form the government, lie every time they open their mouths. Until we resolve that and people begin to question why it is that the Department of Justice routinely deceives jurors to incarcerate innocent people, and we've got a heck of a problem on our hands. Glenn is still with us, but we have Rob calling in from Michigan on one of my favorite topics, which is the question of different dimensions. Hello, Rob.
Hey, Greg. How you doing?
Good.
Good. Yeah, ever since Rory described in dimensions, it's just been really stuck in my mind. I've been really planning on the ideas of, you know, the other dimensions and such. And there's something Larry said in the Shabbat study last week that kind of made me look into the subject a little bit deeper. But
okay. Hey, just 1 second, because I heard Scott speak. Okay, all right. Okay, there was a moment there where you were not coming across, but you are now, so go ahead. So you were in the Shabbat study, you were thinking about the various dimensions and what our buddy down there in Australia had to say.
Yeah, right. And I haven't heard you talk about it on your show or anything, but have you looked into the Hadron Collider, that CERN machine they have running right now?
Yeah, down in CERN, they're trying to find, of course, the boson Higgs particle, and they're essentially accelerating the tiniest particles of matter, such that they can create a fusion reaction. Of course, some people are concerned that they're going to create a mini black hole, which is going to propagate itself and then destroy the planet or turn the thing into a bomb. But you know, I think they're dealing with enormous amounts of energy to but over an extraordinarily small thing. But they're basically trying to figure out how in the universe works. And as they do that, one of the things that strikes me is that each time we learn more about the universe, it retreats inwardly, just as the universe of the stars and galaxies is retreating outwardly beyond our comprehension. The universe is retreating inwardly beyond our comprehension. You know, we realize that matter is made up of molecules. The molecules are made up of individual atoms. The individual atoms are made up of protons and neutrons and electrons. And then the protons and neutrons are made up of quarks and leptons. And then there's these there's energy packets, if you will, that comprise them. Are you, you know, the very universe is retreating inwardly as fast as it's retreating outwardly, both beyond our comprehension.
Right. Yeah.
And what strikes me too is one of the things that's interesting here is that, you know, religious man wanted man to be in the center of the universe, so they had the sun revolve around the earth rather than the other way around. But when you look at the scale of our universe, we are right in the middle of it. In fact, we're not only in the middle of it because the universe is retreating inwardly small and outwardly at about the same rate and same scale, putting us from a size point of view right in the middle of the universe. But at 3.5 dimensions, you know, stuck in the ordinary flow of time, I think there are 7 dimensions. I think 7 dimensions explains the universe as string theory seeks to explain dark matter and dark energy, and time being a dimension. We're in 3.5 dimensions. You know, isn't 3.5 dimensions halfway to 7?
Yeah.
I think we are right in the middle of the universe.
So you're thinking that Yahweh's in the 7th dimension and living outside the universe?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He is definitely exists outside of the fourth dimension. In fact, he is clearly outside the fifth and sixth dimension. So the only way that he could create the four-dimensional construct that we witness in terms of space-time is to be outside that in at least the fifth dimension. And I think there's every reason to suspect that he is actually in the seventh dimension.